Turkey! Tokyo! Australia! Germany! Africa!
Here we go. Head On with Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation, cussing, and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, crmw.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy. It's real, it's radio, and it's the horn. It's 11 minutes late, too. I'm sorry about that, but it was difficult to avoid. We just got back from an appointment, the boss and I did, and came howling through the door trying to... Oh, well, you get the idea. Yeah. This is the horn. HeadOnRadioNetwork.com is where we live. That's where you go if you want to jump into the chat room, but you know that. Pick out a screen name, pick out a password, unless you've already got one. And jump right into the thick of things, into the midst of the madcap merriment, the zaniness, the multimedia extravaganza that is the Horn chat room during the hours during which this program is live, namely, and to wit, 6 to 9 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time, Monday through Friday. You will be met by Anatole and Jugapunch and Jules and Laborman and Little Gray and Steve from Georgistan, all capably moderated by longtime inveterate, indefatigable chat room moderators Lottie and Sparky. Sparky deciding not to exercise his third stage guild navigator skills and folding space to become man cave because it's like a blast furnace in there. At least that's what I'm guessing. Yes. Brother Deacon Asa says, a tad bit late, but otherwise loud and clear on my Magnavox Odyssey 2 via TuneIn, Brother Bob. Thank you. Thank you. Brother Deacon Asa tries to listen from a different antiquated device every evening. Yes, yes, indeed. Hi, I'm Bob Kincaid. Let's get that in early, except for the intro part that gets it right off the bat. But that doesn't really count now, does it? This is a listener-supported program. There's no you'll not be bothered by any ads during this program. There will be no encouragements for you to purchase a Bose Wave radio to listen to while you're waiting for your herbal hair regrowth tonic capsules to work as you lie on your mattress made of foam developed by NASA and handcrafted by Swedes. And no one will come by and drop a bowling ball on the mattress and then pick it up with an auric vacuum cleaner. All within the confines of your General Steel building and on your Lumber Liquidator's toxic floor. None of that will, and nobody's going to ask you to buy gold now. There's never been a better time to buy gold. Buy low, buy high and sell low because you're a chump. No, none of that will happen here. The only thing that will happen here is conversation, because this is conversation radio. Mm-hmm. Operators are standing by. Nah, actually, I'm the one doing the standing by. I guess I'm the operator. Hello? Okay, much better. So that's what will happen. And it will continue to happen each and every night as long as you continue to support the program. When last we left the program, Matt in San Francisco had put a challenge on the table that had $89 remaining in it in regard to the 103 people who were turned into ciphers by the for-profit media and by the right wing who couldn't bring themselves to acknowledge the gay LGBT nature of the victims of the Orlando massacre. That is on the table. So we've got about $289 to raise this evening. $28.90 times 10, or 10 times $28.90, or one person at $289.90. No, one person at $289. Let's not get ahead of ourselves. And it, you, well, you know, how, that's how it works, and hopefully I won't have to mention this evening several times this evening, and it'll just, you know, happen kind of miraculously. Oh, my goodness, it being Prayer Meeting Wednesday, and it is, because it's the 22nd day of June 2016, which is a Wednesday, which means it is Prayer Meeting Wednesday. Chat Room Jesus has entered the room. All hail, hail, hail. The Lord's all here. Right, yes. No, it's Prayer Meeting Wednesday on the Horn, and brethren and sister, and we were a little late. We were a little late getting to dinner, which means we had to call ahead for a carry-out tray, but the little old blue-haired ladies worked up a scrumptious batch of chicken and dumplings this evening. You know, we could do it two or three times a month, as far as I'm concerned. Love me some chicken and dumplings. You know, nicely steamed. They weren't at all sad or doughy in the middle. Oh, they do know how to do it. Yes, they do. And the soup is nice and thick and rich and hearty. And there's, oh my goodness gracious, it's nothing short of delicious. And you know, there was a macaroni salad and the potato salad and. Yeah, we're not real fancy. We don't call it pasta salad. It's just macaroni salad. And the potato salad is so good. Oh, it's so good. It got a nice little sour cream tang to it. It does. The potato salad. And well, the blackberries are beginning to come ripe because we've had a ripe. You know, blackberries like the rain. The blackberries are beginning to come ripe. And mercy sakes, what goes. Oh, what the little old blue haired ladies in the fellowship hall kitchen can do. With some fresh blackberries and a cobbler and a few youngins to turn the crank on the ice cream freezer. Oh! But of course it was all just gone through like a hurricane by the deacons who, having gotten their fill, trundled their bulks upstairs out to where they stood smoking in the parking lot with the sinners. Luckily, we have Carol Baker to send out with the cattle prod, and she did her usual excellent job driving the deacons back out of the parking lot, making them put out their smokes. They'd been chain smoking three or four of them. It's tough to get through a 3-hour service without going out for a smoke break. She drove them out of the parking lot, in through the vestibule, down past that bowl of 20-year-old desiccated butter mints, and they're waiting right down front, brethren and sister, and right down front. Even as I speak, for the minister of music to come up, and we will begin the service this evening as ever with our offertory hymn, brethren and sistren, with every head bowed and every eye closed, as the great big heavy brass plate with the velvet liner in the bottom and the little button that says PayPal on it, as it comes by, just press that PayPal button. And help us knock down $289 worth of fundraising this evening, $200 and an $89 deficit. Thank you very kindly, brethren and sister. And it's your love offerings, your seed faith offerings, that keeps the cathedral open and operating. So as the deacons fan out into the sanctuary. Brethren and sister, and I will call upon the minister of music to come forward with and lead us in our offertory hymn. Brother minister of music, ha, glory, if you would, please.
And he said, it's time for you to leave behind the things of this world. The fine houses, the fancy cars, the flashy clothes, because we are all naked in the eyes of the Lord.
Stop! This man is clinically insane!
Ladies and gentlemen, in the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit, let me hear you say, Amen!
Amen!
Let me hear you say,
Praise the Lord!
Let me hear you say, I will empty the contents of my wallet into that little collection plate when it comes around!
I will empty the contents of my wallet into that little plate when it comes around!
And it's all tax-free. Hallelujah! Praise the Lord for all the cash I've got. Praise Him for my Rolls Royce and my yacht. Serving God ain't hard with a credit card. Jesus died so I could make a lot. Praise the Lord, He's made us millionaires. Wave your donations in the air. We've replaced our hymns with ATMs, and soon we'll charge a fee on every prayer. Jesus Christ was a poor man, don't you know? He should have used our accountants for his cash flow. Stop the Sermon on the Mount, he should have had a bank account. 2,000 years with interest, he'd be rolling in the dough. Praise the Lord, this song's out on CD, just $40.95 plus GST. Hallelujah, plenty of moolah, solid gold baubles on my Christmas tree. I've got all of heaven's riches, thanks to all you stupid bitches. Praise the Lord for modern Christianity. Whoever said religion should be free?
Oh, mercy notes and dozy notes and little lambs in ivy, a kiddly divy too. Wouldn't you, brethren and sistren, ha, glory, I love you. This is Prayer Meeting Wednesday, oh, in the Cathedral of Common Sense, brethren and sistren, and I'm telling you what, I want you right now. Do not wait, for we never know what the next instant shall bring, brethren and sistren, ha, glory, sanctify. I want you to get up out of your seat. Get up onto your feet and come on out from the pews and head on down that blood-red aisle and fall, ha, glory, upon your knees at the altar, ha, and lay your hands upon the subwoofer and feel the healing rays of common sense flowing through you. From the server on high. Ha! Glory, hallelujah. I am Archpope, Uber Rabbi, Ultimate Imam, Animated Animist, Antagonized Agnostic, Vicarious Vicar, Maximum Metropolitan, Bob Kincaid, and it is Prayer Meeting Wednesday on the horn, brethren and sisters. And I've just gotten the report back from the deacons. Glory, glory. I'm here to say, I can tell you right now, that a Nonny Moose limb, no, there's no limb there. A Nonny Moose and Brother Deacon Asa have together knocked down all but $9 of Matt and San Francisco's challenge. Amen. Amen. Feel the power of this community in action. How glory. Brethren and sistren, I tell you now, verily, verily, I say unto you, that the work of the Lord is far from being accomplished in our sinful Lent. Glory, hallelujah, so far from being accomplished. But the work is being done. I offer up to you for your consideration of Christian goodness, Christian righteousness, Christian sanctity. Sanctification. Ha! I offer you Pastor Donnie Romero of the Steadfast Baptist Church in Fort Worth, Texas. Stand. Glory. We're a little low, about a week and a half now away out from the carnage, the massacre at Orlando, brethren and sistren. And Pastor Donnie Romero of the Steadfast Baptist Church in Fort Worth, Texas, Stan. Well, he wants to make sure that his flock understands exactly what happened. When he took to the pulpit on Sunday, brethren and sister, and hack glory, he said, "These 50 sodomites are all perverts and pedophiles, and they are the scum of the earth, and the earth is a little bit better place now. And I'll take it a step further," Pastor Donnie said, "because I heard on the news today that there are still several dozen of these queers in ICU and intensive care, and I will pray to God like I did this morning. I will do it tonight. I'll pray that God will finish the job that man started, and he will end their life. And by tomorrow morning, they will all be burning in hell, just like the rest of them, so that they don't get any more opportunity to go out and hurt little children. Behold, brethren and sistren, the peace that passeth all understanding. Behold the loving grace of Christ Jesus, crucified, killed, and resurrected for our sins. 'Cause God is love, y'all. Now, you might be a-wondering how it is that Donnie Romero got to be a preacher. How he got himself a church like Steadfast Baptist there in Fort Worth, Texas. Well, he was ordained to preach by Pastor Steven Anderson of Arizona Stan. The same one who praised God for the murder of what he called 50 sodomites. I guess he was including Omar Mateen in the sodomite and count. Oh, brethren and sistren, be not deceived, for yea, verily, here is mainstream American Christianity. Brethren and sistren, how do we know this? We know this because the cult to which Pastor Donnie Romero belongs, namely the Baptist Church, has remained absolutely silent in regard to the words of Pastor Donnie Romero, because the Baptist Church is in agreement, brethren and sistren. The largest Protestant denomination in the United States of America is in agreement with a man who celebrates the murder of individuals who were allegedly created by his alleged God. I know there are Christians out there who say, "No, that's not my Christianity." But baby, it is. This is mainstream Christianity. These are Baptists. There are more Baptists than there are any other kind of Protestants in America. Okay? And there's not a lot of difference between Pastor Donnie Romero, for instance, and Baptist Pastor Roger Jimenez of the Verity Baptist Church in California. After the Orlando massacre, Pastor Jimenez said, "Are you to his flock?" He said, "Are you sad that 50 pedophiles were killed today? I think Orlando, Florida, is a little safer tonight. The tragedy is that more of them didn't die. The tragedy is I'm kind of upset he didn't finish the job." This is a spokesman for the Saving Grace. How sweet the sound, the amazing grace that is Christianity. Baptist Christianity. Of course, Pastor Jimenez is losing his lease. The owner of the building where his church is, I have asked him that to consider, you know, moving right now. Stand not upon the order of your going, but go at once. That's not in the Bible, that's in Shakespeare. But they were both written in the same language. Yeah. What do you make of that? How do you explain that away? How do you make that not be Christianity? Because I can't. Yeah. Oh, by the way, brethren and sisters, we have a special announcement from brother Deacon Gerald, the deacon in charge of the Building and Grounds Committee. The first floor men's room is closed until further notice. Seems there's been some sort of an exorcism performed in there. Thank you, praise Jesus, glory under God forever and ever, Amen. Post no bills. Use no hooks, and don't use the first floor men's restroom, please. Wouldn't it be nice to live in a country where we could do something about the Pastor Jimenez's and the Pastor Anderson's and the Pastor, who was the other dickhead? Pastor Romero. I wonder what it must be like in countries where that kind of speech is not tolerated because it serves to advance no social purpose, no political purpose, no purpose at all whatsoever. I bet you it's a much more civil country where that much more decent country, a much less hateful country, where that kind of crap, that kind of bilge, that kind of bilious hogwash, that kind of putrid filth is not poured onto our body politic. I mean, oddly enough, I have not seen any evidence of any of the countries that have hate speech laws. I have not seen any evidence that they are in any way having problems. I've not seen any evidence that God, when's the last time God sent a tornado to knock down a whole bunch of churches in Sweden? Right? Yeah. I mean, kind of hard not to notice that.
That's some love. Oh, I am informed anonymously, Brother Deacon Gerald, that was not an exorcism in the first four men's room. It was a deacon who had overconsumed and felt the tater salad had been left out in the heat a mite too long. Brother Gerald, you might want to get the hazmat suit of holiness and just kind of march on in there. And well, there's nothing to do but to do it and get it taken care of.
Yeah.
Yeah, these are great days. They're great days for Christianity. I mean, let's consider, shall we? And unfortunately, our friends to the north, the oh-so-civil Canadians, are not immune to the poison that is Christianity. This is the story of Alex Radita. When he was 3 years old, young Alex was diagnosed with diabetes. Juvenile diabetes is quite manageable. It isn't pleasant. No disease is. But it is manageable. Glucose monitoring, that kind of thing. Well, at least the Canadian government is doing something about the religious insanity in its midst. Alex Radita lived to be 15 years old. His parents, Emil and Radhika Radita, have been on trial in Canada for first-degree murder. Because by the time he was 15 years old, Alex Radita weighed no more than a four-year-old child. They were members of the Romanian Pentecostal Church. When, weighing only as much as a four-year-old, 15-year-old Alex Radita died because his parents had refused to seek medical care in a country that has universal health care for all of the people in that country, where ability to pay is not an issue at all. When his parents refused to seek medical care for young Alex, members of the congregation were told that, yes, young Alex had died overnight, but that he had been raised from the dead. Because, you see, if you buy into the Christian mythology story, you think that dead people can come back to life, which, interestingly, they do not do. It was nothing more than a matter of monitoring his blood glucose levels and providing insulin as needed. The medical examiner said it is quite possible that Alex may have stopped breathing hours before paramedics were called. Church elders finally intervened and told the parents to call 911. When the paramedics showed up, they found the elders and the parents praying over the emaciated corpse of the little boy, trying to get up now. Oh, glory. Get up now. Rise up, just like it says right there in the Bible all the time. All these people are rising up from the dead. Just get on up there. Get on up. It didn't work. The saddest thing is that there's governmental failure in this case as well. After he was diagnosed, he was hospitalized 3 times because his parents would not treat his diabetes. And so then Child Services removed him from the home. And they complied with treating his condition for a while, and then they quit again because they were just sure that Jesus was gonna heal him, and that even if he died, that Jesus would, you know, reanimate his lifeless body. People are grieving over his death. His kindergarten teacher, Sandy Wong, said, "I hope that Alex's tragic death will bring about necessary changes regarding follow-up and monitoring in serious cases of neglect when once apprehended children are returned to their parents. His life story of suffering and premature death demands that greater, more open sharing of information between provinces be implemented. The most vulnerable must be protected. I will never forget Alex's sweet face and the privilege it was to teach, support, and encourage him during his kindergarten year. He is free of his suffering now and resting in peace." We insist on calling something like death peace when it is nothing more than death. One has to be aware in order to have peace, and there is no awareness in the grave. His parents, his Christian parents, murdered him as surely as if they had used a firearm. But again, as I said, at least the Canadian government is trying to do something about it. There seems to be some interest in Canada to dealing with this wherever it happens. The trial continues. Mentioned this a couple of weeks back. The trial continues, or the case continues, of the parents convicted in April in Canada of failing to provide the necessities of life for a 19-month-old little boy, David and Colette Steffen. They're up for sentencing this week. You might recall that they blamed the emergency workers on the death of the little fella. They claim that they are victims of a conspiracy to silence anti-vaccine advocates. That's right, they're anti-vaxxers. They even participated to an extent in the production of an anti-vax film, Vaxxed, by filmmaker Del Bigtree. These people who treated their child's illness with maple syrup have declared, David Steffen said, it's becoming quite a parental rights issue for medical choice, for how we deem to treat our children, and ultimately what it comes down to is whether we have the right to vaccinate or not to vaccinate without being held liable, or whether or not we have to rush our children to the doctor every time they get just the sniffles in fear that something may just randomly happen and then we're held liable. Because that's exactly what didn't happen. David Steffen says the emergency crew didn't have the proper equipment to provide oxygen to the child after they tried CPR on him. Which leads one to wonder why the child needed CPR. Maybe being denied medication and given maple syrup instead had something to do with it. See, the child had meningitis. David Steffen said, we were treating our child with different homeopathic remedies, different herbal remedies, like tens of thousands of people do, nothing out of the ordinary, and he wasn't severely ill, and everything just came to a crash on an evening, and we ended up in an ambulance, and he didn't have the right equipment, and subsequently ended up brain dead. This isn't just our battle, this is everyone's battle. Well, yeah, it's everyone's battle who tries to treat meningitis with maple syrup! I mean, I love maple syrup as not much as the next guy, but I don't think it's going to fix meningitis. I don't know what kind of sentence is available to the judge, but I hope the judge throws the book at him, eh? And of course, they've got a business hustling their herbal remedies. So, you know, because Jesus. Because prayer meeting Wednesday. Let's check in with one of America's leading Christian hate mongers. How's about, remember Kevin Swanson? He's the one that invited Rafaelito Eduardo Cruz, the anointed booger-eating future king of America, son of Rafael Eduardo Cruz, the man who forgot to become an American for a really long time, and a lot of other wing nuts and friends of Jesus, to come and speak to some sort of Liberty for Christ or whatever meeting that he held where they all talked about how badly homosexual people need to be murdered in the name of the state. He's, of course, out of Colorado because, there's nowhere in this country where this kind of hate cannot breed because this entire country has been made a breeding ground for hate. Out of our delicate sensibilities about the religion industry. This guy is a dominionist and quite possibly a reconstructionist who wants a government based upon Old Testament law that will literally execute people for how they love each other. Because somewhere back in the dim mists of the Bronze Age, some wandering semi-nomadic people decided that they didn't want homosexuality in their midst and decided the best way to do that was to kill people whom they deemed to be gay. Well, he's not backing down. Oh, hell no. Because Orlando. Oh, by the way, Brother Deacon Asa up in Canada says, don't knock maple syrup, Brother Bob. We use it to cure any number of ailments. What do you think they do in Russia when little Dmitri has a case of the sniffles? That's right, they put some vodka on him. We use the maple syrup in that very same fashion, eh? Carol Baker pointing out, I don't treat medical issues with condiments, so kids shouldn't suffer it. And by the way, Carol says, Brother Gerald, you need to just don the hazmat suit and really quit fooling around. Brother Deacon Gerald said, well, if it's God's will, so it shall be done. Pray for me, brothers and sisters. I'm going in. It takes a lot for the team. They're running the Building and Grounds Committee of Deacons. Because, you know, the other deacons are nowhere to be found when this happens. Oh, Brother Deacon Gerald, I mean, you know how this stuff works, right? Yeah. So Orlando happened, and as we've seen from Brother Romero and Brother Jimenez and Brother Anderson, they each and every one of them saw a golden opportunity to vomit filth out into the universe and all over us, and Kevin Swanson's no different. They're competing for the same slice of the same pie. I mean, how much tax-free money is there to go around among people who get off on other people being murdered?
The Muslims have something of a love-hate relationship with homosexuality from the beginning, but almost all pagan societies have had a love-hate relationship with homosexuality, friends. When it comes to it, human beings try to build up these gigantic dams to keep sin from completely destroying their nations, but these dams burst again and again and again. That's because the heart is deceitful above all things and desperately wicked. Who can know it? And Romans 7:11 speaks of sin seizing an opportunity through the commandment, deceived me, and through the commandment put me...
Wait, there's a 7-Eleven in Rome? What's Italian for big gulp? Never mind.
Me to death for sin had that tremendous influence over me. Now, again, why do homosexuals murder homosexuals? And that's the question I think a lot of people are facing right now after these Orlando shootings. And Romans 1, again, I think is the answer to this question. For this reason, God gave them up to vile passions. For even their women exchanged the natural use for what is against nature. Likewise, also the men, leaving the natural use of the woman, burned in their lust for one another. Men with men committing what is shameful and receiving themselves the penalty of the error which is due.
Yeah, he's just blowing right through all that, isn't it? Isn't he? Of course, we went over that verse, if you recall. And I stopped along the way at referring to the natural use of the woman. Not the natural participation of the woman. Not the natural copulation with the woman, but the use of the woman. Because according to Paul, who by the time he was allegedly writing Romans was pretty well gone around the bend and life was just one long first century CE Pink Floyd song for him, women were to be used. That's why you can tell them how they're to wear their hair and to shut up in church and not ask any questions, and if she's got any questions, to wait till she gets home and ask her husband, who probably has no more idea than she did, because, you know, it's the first century CE, and, well, atne ute aitbre, if you one what I in me. But do continue and show us the goodness of Christianity, please, Brother Swanson.
Even as they did not like to retain God in their knowledge, God gave them over to a debased mind. There it is, a debased mind, to do those things not fitting, being filled with all unrighteousness, sexual immorality, wickedness, covetousness, maliciousness, full of envy, murder, and...
Slow down, Kev. You got all day. I mean, it's your radio show, isn't it, buddy? And did you notice that business at the beginning about how Muslims have a love-hate relationship with homosexuality? Well, the fact of the matter is, Christians hate homosexuals more than any other religion. And as a result of that, Kevin Swanson should shut the fuck up. Yeah, I guess he takes it that his deity approves of what he's saying because the deity doesn't squish him like a bug or send a tornado to land on him or hit him with a lightning bolt or a flood or anything like that. Yep, still here. Okay, I can keep hating. God loves it. God's love, y'all. Yeah, back to you, Kev.
So, friends, there it is. The sin of murder in Romans chapter 1, verse 29, connected with the sin of homosexuality. Sin breeds sin, which breeds more sin, which breeds more sin. That's the nature of man without the salvation of Jesus Christ. And
really? Is it? Because, see, I reject the idea of the salvation of Jesus Christ. I think it's a bunch of baloney. That doesn't mean other people can't believe it, but I'm pretty sure that it is. And oddly enough, I do not feel the compunction to murder anyone. But to hear Kevin Swanson tell it, if you're not a Christian, I mean, you're just going to murder. But it didn't pass the smell test with Marty either. Marty said, do homosexuals murder homosexuals? Also, why do heterosexuals murder other heterosexuals, especially the male killing the female? Most murders in this country are heterosexual on heterosexual murders simply by dint of statistics. And the presence of the relative presence of gays versus straights in our society. Why is there not an outcry about straight on straight murders? Why, as Marty points out, do we not describe the annual litany of men killing spouses, paramours, significant others, girlfriends, whatever you want to call them, human beings, as a heterosexual murder problem? And given the makeup of this country, about 80% of people in this country say they believe in some kind of deity, why don't we describe it as a Christian murder problem? Well, because if we did that, they'd all get their ladders out and start scrambling all over each other to get up on the cross and holler about how they're being persecuted.
And this violence, this murder, seems to attend the sin of homosexuality. In 2013, the CDC released the results of a 2010 study on victimization by sexual orientation and found for gay men, 40% of homosexual men had been abused by violent partners. 40% of homosexual men had been abused by their violent partners compared to 21% for straight men, meaning that twice as prevalent.
So gay men are twice as likely to be abused by their significant other as straight men. Why am I not surprised by this, and where's the number on straight women who have been abused? Because I'm guessing it's north of 40%. Let's not talk about that, though.
Amongst homosexual men than amongst straight men. So there's a report from the CDC that indicates that homosexuality tends to attract more violence than heterosexuality as well. Well, what's the bottom line as we view what's happening in Orlando today? I think it is, again, the Romans 1 scenario in which God gives them up. Remember, it's God in his common grace, in his common mercy, that prevents society from breaking out to total chaos, to total anarchy, and to the sort of bloodbaths that we see in places like Orlando. Ultimately, it's only God that can prevent the human heart from bursting forth and engaging in such horrible, horrible effects upon human society. And Orlando is a picture in which God's common grace, his restraints have been lifted entirely. And when God doesn't restrain, people go nuts in their sins.
Except for the fact that they don't. And again, you heard the clip. There's not a word in there about heterosexual men beating hell out of, murdering heterosexual women. Because it doesn't fit with his thesis. Because if his thesis were true, and you had a vastly higher number of women who were abused by men, then you would kind of have to conclude that there was something desperately wrong with heterosexual relationships. Even, you know, the Christian ones. Brother Deacon Gerald is happy to announce that the first floor men's restroom has been reopened. It is, and now we should note here in the cathedral, the men's restroom may be used. You know, we don't impose gender norms on any of that, so you understand. But it's but that restroom is in fact back open. And if you think there's going to be a problem with potato salad, for God's sakes, don't eat it. Got it? Okay. This is I know, disgusting stuff, and I'm sorry if it's such a downer. Maybe we should be talking about happy things like, you know, rainbows and unicorns. Unfortunately, though, these are the people who define our culture. Mainly because they won't shut them up. Mainly because they insist upon defining the culture. Yeah, 'tis a puzzlement. It's it seems a problem that we're not going to be sorting out anytime soon, I guess. And it's a damn shame, too. Because it just means we're going to have more of the same. I'm sorry, we carry on and we have our fun. But sometimes when you hear just how full of hate these monstrosities are, you can't help but wonder just what hope there is. For us in this country, especially the normal people. Because the Kevin Swansons of this world are damned well determined to try to destroy anything good we have and turn us into a theocracy, the likes of which would make an Ayatollah blush. One on every corner. Steve, a member of the Trinity of Steve, says, Bob, Romans 7:11, for sin seizing the opportunity, it killed me. Oh, yeah, that's the one they used to print on the icy cups, right? 7:11, 7:11, yeah. And I guess we've got an opportunity for a giggle. Because the Christians are up in arms, and yes, this goes back to Kevin Swanson again. Kevin Swanson is still having a hissy about the animated character Elsa from the Disney movie Frozen. Over on Twitter. Which is basically the national outrage machine. There was a bit of a campaign to, and I shouldn't chuckle, a campaign to sort of normalize what seems a rather awkward situation for one of their properties. It was the there was the hashtag Give Elsa a Girlfriend, because they're making Frozen 2. Give Elsa a Girlfriend, and people tweeted about it. I hope Disney makes Elsa a lesbian princess. Imagine how iconic that would be. Dear at Disney, hashtag give Elsa a girlfriend. And then it took off. A gay Disney princess would have helped me feel so much more normal when I was younger. Representation is important. If I'd seen a queer female in a Disney film, I wouldn't have felt so alone when I was younger, struggling with coming out, said another person. Hashtag give Elsa a girlfriend, because love is an open door. Another person said, I absolutely do adore the idea of give Elsa a girlfriend. Kids need to know that love comes in different varieties and it's okay to be who you are. Well, it's not okay to be who you are if you're Kevin Swanson. Because we have to be how Kevin wants us to be. Carol Baker noting there is some irony involved here. The big song from Frozen was Let It Go. Carol noting, yeah, those Clinton, those Christian fucktards need to let it go. But they can't, because they can't live in a world where people simply get to be who they are. People have to be who the fundamentalist, evangelical, upstanding, God-fearing, Bible-believing, gundamentalist, amosexuals say they should be. And while sexuality is their present battlefield, it's not all they've got. Like I said, you may recall Kevin Swanson having a hissy about Elsa before. He's absolutely fixated on her. I would not like to know what goes on while he's watching Frozen, you know, in his boxer shorts with that bag of Cheetos. Yeah, you're welcome. I got the image in my mind. All we got in common is our misery, so the least we can do is share it, okay? But yeah, here's Kevin Swanson.
Anybody who opposes the homosexualizing of the kids is shamed for it and has been shamed, and very few people have stood against the homosexualizing of children. And
oh, time out. I thought I was going to get through this clip. How does one homosexualize a child? How does one homosexualize anybody? How do you homosexualize a polar bear? How do you homosexualize a 30-something, a millennial, a boomer? How do you homosexualize somebody? Is there a gay ray? Or is it like something out of Men in Black, only it's a disco ball? And you're mesmerized by music being played at 135 beats per minute. Because I'm kind of lost here. Homosexualize. Now, there's sexualizing. God knows the fashion industry sexualizes little girls constantly. And, you know, the for-profit media help, too. Witness, you know, the poor little pageant girl children. Hint, you can't homosexualize somebody because one is either gay or not. If a straight person tries to be gay, they're going to be as miserable as a gay person trying to be straight. But you cannot explain that to a Kevin Swanson because a Kevin Swanson is absolutely concreted in to his Bronze Age notions of human behavior. You know, those particular people were baffled by rain and wheelbarrows and air and lightning and bathing. Answering my question, Carol Baker says, how do you homosexualize a kid? I think it has something to do with Target bathrooms and unisex fitting rooms. So I hear, and there's no such word as homosexualize. I didn't think so. Damn. Okay, Kev, make your case. No, don't.
K-6 schools in Douglas County, Colorado, or anywhere else where the GLSEN program is constantly being pushed.
So are you saying that you've taken flack for this?
Well, all you need to do to prove the point that anybody who opposes the homosexualizing of the kids' agenda is shamed, all you need to do is check out Kevin Swanson and the word frozen on your Google search.
Yeah, because when you do that, you'll find out that Kevin Swanson is an idiot. And everybody knows that but Kevin Swanson. You know, there are children out there, and you know, gay and straight alike can testify to it, that they just knew who they were. I saw a video on Facebook the other day of a little girl named Corey. And the video was shot inside a restroom, naturally. Corey's 15, 16 years old. And like any other girl, Corey wanted to play with dolls and dress up and wear mommy's shoes and play in mommy's makeup from about the time that she started walking. Corey, unfortunately, was born with a penis. Which is, can you imagine if we defined, I mean, do we define, why a penis? Why don't we define maleness by prostates? Or, if you want to get right down to it, let's define maleness by chromosomes. Oh, but there's trouble, because then if you dig past the chromosome a little way, you might start looking around inside the human genome and find out that it was far more complex than a penis or a prostate or secondary sexual characteristics like breasts or Adam's apples. But Kevin Swanson can't live in a complicated world like that. Which suggests to me that Kevin Swanson probably has some of his own questions. You reckon, Kevin Swanson ever watched the, those juvenilia vampire movies, and said, "Demons, see, this is demons." And that's a very handsome demon there. That is downright good looking demon. God forgive me. Yeah.
And you'll see that there is somebody who attempted it. I tested it. I know it. Anybody who has the guts to stand up against the homosexualizing of kids in the present day will be shamed for it. And that means that the homosexualizing of kids will be, I think, wholesale happening across this country in the next 2, 3, 4, 5, 10 years.
Well, at least the sexualizing of little girls is being done retail.
Of course. Elsa is going to get her girlfriend eventually. That's the way you destroy sexuality. That's the way you destroy an entire civilization. The entire social system of the United States of America is collapsing. But in order for the...
Wait, what? Huh? Giving a cartoon character a girlfriend is how you destroy sexuality in America? What? I mean, now, granted, Kevin Swanson, if you ever see a photograph of him, is a genuine pencil neck geek. And so the potential dating pool for him has always probably been pretty shallow. Is that what's under his skin, that the dating pool just keeps getting shallower and shallower and shallower for pencil neck geeks like Kevin Swanson? Nobody shamed him. No. They are pointing out his ignorance. They are pointing out his stupidity. They're not shaming. They're pointing and laughing because he's a fool. A jackass. Oh, by the way, update. Carol Baker says, I just looked up that character in Frozen. I think I caught the gay. She's cute. Oh, she's adorable. And blonde? Oh, you should see what happens to an 8-year-old little girl who was born with lovely brunette hair when she sees blonde little Elsa. Mommy, can I dye my hair? You know, at 8. No, dear. Finish up, Kev.
System to collapse, you've got to be sure that the destruction maintains a cross-generational vision. You've got to be sure that you have homosexualized 4-year-olds and 6-year-olds and 8-year-olds and 10-year-olds in order to destroy a civilization, because the destruction of a civilization happens over 2 or 3 or maybe 4 generations max. In order to bring a civilization down, you've got to homosexualize the kids.
Has this guy ever even been around a 4-year-old? Because there's not a lot of sexuality to a 4-year-old. Now, 4-year-olds can generally tell when they're being hurt or abused. And this guy is an abuser of children, because he doesn't want to let children be who they are. My God. Can you imagine what Kevin Swanson would do to an effeminate little boy. Reminds me of the case out of Florida from, oh, probably a decade back now, where daddy beat his little boy to death to try to beat him, to try to keep him from getting the gay. And what's it going to do to that little four-year-old boy when his daddy takes him into the shower and shakes his dong at him like Kevin's buddy James Dobson wants him to do? Hey, Jesus. Well, I think that's a strong likelihood, Carol points out. He's never been around a goddamn gay person. Or even an undamned gay person. Yeah, there's the issue. They're not scary in person, only in theory. And you know what? Not even in theory, Carol. They're only scary in the fetid, dirty imaginations of people like Kevin Swanson. Lordy, I can't wait until the day that Kevin Swanson gets caught snorting meth off a gay hooker's butt. It has a real transformative effect, as Brother Haggard showed. Earther writing, how do you homosexualize a polar bear? You give it a fabulous scarf. The hard part is putting it on the bear. Hi, Brother Bob. Hi, Earther. Yeah, I'll leave that. Yes, I'll leave that right, exactly. So let's take a break now. Almost halfway into the program, I have once again over-filibobstered. They've been having a sit-in in the House of Representatives, so I don't feel too terribly bad about it. Trying to demand a vote out of Eddie Munster, Paul Ryan, on issues relating to guns. But we'll take a break. Lines are open. The stress line is 304-663-4676. It's free and as easy as, well, I mean, most people, we don't have a toll-free line anymore, mainly because most people have some sort of a calling plan that does, long-distance toll charges have largely gone the way of the dodo. So that's one of the two numbers. The stress line is 304-663-4676. You don't have to be stressed out to use it. It's just named after Bill Mr. Stress Miller. The other number, of course, 304-574-8178. And from anywhere on planet Earth, Bob Kincaid Horn, B-O-B-K-I-N-C-A-I-D-H-O-R-N, Bob Kincaid Horn. So jump in any way you feel so motivated, and we'll take a break, and we'll all fervently meditate in the direction of the idea of Kevin Swanson getting caught in a public park bathroom with a man in his mouth. Because he can't do things like this without the goddess of irony catching up with him. This is listener-supported conversation radio. We've got about $209 to go in fundraising this evening. Hopefully we'll meet that goal. I'm Bob Kincaid. Thinking how you did me wrong, and I grew strong, and I learned how to get along. Yeah, I thought that an inspired choice for bumping out of Kevin Swanson there. Let's run up to Connecticut on the stress line. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hi, Bob. How are you?
I'm well.
Kevin, of course.
Yeah, hey, Kevin. Yeah, yeah. A far better Kevin than the one I was listening to just now.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I was sitting here saying, oh, God, that idiot had my name.
Make him give it back.
I said I hate when somebody I don't like, especially like a guy like that, has my name. I'm like, oh God, don't try to transfer that onto me. So anyway, you know, I called about these religious people, but I just wanted to mention that I don't know if you've been reading David Sirota's exposés on the Governor Malloy of Connecticut. He's a real. The legislature overrode three bills because people are, these legislators now are afraid they're going to get ousted out of office. And the AFL-CIO of Connecticut was holding support for Democrats this time. You know, so that's I just want to update you on Malloy. And again, I think he's not a very good man. But anyway, you know, these people, I'm not going to take too much time.
All the time you need. Do not rush yourself.
Okay. Well, anyway, you know, listening to these people, you know, and I heard this before, and I went online one night, and I wanted a Raw story, and I read this stuff, you know, and I'm saying, these people are always talking about Sharia law invading this country. Well, let me tell you, these people, we already have laws in this country, public policy and laws that have been passed to appease. And actually, that faith-based initiative, I was totally against that. That President Obama actually increased funding for it.
Oh, yeah, so, and George Bush started it. I remember when remember when the push was on and we spent $1 million or something on advertising for the adoption of snowflake, what were called snowflake babies. Remember the little unwanted frozen embryos?
Yeah.
Yeah, as long as they were little white embryos, mind you.
You know, if I can find it, Bob, I did a paper arguing against it, faith-based initiative. If I can find it, I'll email it to you.
Cool.
Yeah, I brought up some legal cases. It's been about, you know, I wrote it when the bill was being passed, so I wrote it before the bill was passed, and I argued against it. But anyhow, if I find it, I'll definitely email it to you. But you know, the thing is, getting back to these nutcases, you know, if you were to, Noam Chomsky said it about something else one time, but you know, he said it in relation to the crazy Bush administration people, what they wanted to do around the world, but. You know, if you were to look, I guess, from another planet, you know, and you heard these people, you probably wouldn't want to come to this Earth, you know, if these people what people are hearing. I mean, they're not crazy. They're, you know, I think, you know, talking about people that are insane, these people, I think, are, you know, and I'm not a psychiatrist, but I tell you, these people are, whew, I would never want to go to their church. You know, years back when I was trying different churches when I was a younger person, I went to some of these evangelical churches. I grew up a Catholic, you know, and I remember when I was still, you know, I don't go to, I'm not into religion anymore. I don't go to church or anything. But I remember I walked right back into the Catholic church like the week after. I said, oh, boy, as bad as the Catholic church was, these people are worse. That's my opinion anyway. You know, these, I don't get these people. My uncle was a convert, and you know, he'd talk your ear. If you went over to visit him, he'd get on, you know, he'd try to convert, you know, me and my father all the time. It was unbelievable. We used to just roll our eyes. We let him talk on and on and on, you know. But it's just unbelievable. And well, you know, evangelicals, there's a lot of similarities between evangelicals and Islamic fundamentalists. You know, as much as they don't want to think that, you know, there is, you know, and their views are on social issues are pretty much the same too. So, you know, so for them, you know, they're just dishonest people. You know, they don't mind lying. They actually admit it, that right? They admit that sometimes you have to lie, right? The necessary lie, right?
Right.
So you know, they're not good people. You know, I know I'm generalizing, but you know something, you know, if you go to those churches, you're gonna probably buy into that crap. You know, oh yeah, and they'll always deny that they're into killing, but you know, they condone violence. To me, they're violent in their thoughts and what they say. They'll say other people are evil in their heart while they're talking evil things, you know. Although I don't believe in that good and evil stuff, but I guess it's sort of evil, right? If you're glad people died. I mean, that was very disturbing.
Well, at the very least, if we're not going to, I mean, evil is, as you point out, a very freighted word, Kevin. But can we at least all agree that it's really nasty?
Yeah. When are these people going to stop getting a free pass on criticism? People are, well, they have freedom of religion. Well, you know something? You know, I'm tired of that freedom of religion stuff just to be able to say whatever you want, right? If a Muslim was to have said what those people have said, right, you know, they'd probably be on the, you know, they'd probably be brought in by the authorities the next day or the same day, right? So, you know, it's just a double standard. You know, and that's been a knock on the United States for so long around the world, is the double standards that, you know, and you see that in domestic policy all the time. And, you know, and basically, you know, I view it over the last, you know, 30 years, you know, I guess, you know, that there's an Atlantic article, I guess, about how, you know, how did this happen to our political system? Well, that's just another, you know, very glib article about how it got to this way. You know, this has been, you know, the United States has been a tough country to live in probably before we were born, right? I mean,
yeah,
since Reconstruction, right? This country's been, you know, and even before that, this country's always been, you know, if you read Bernard Bailyn's book, right, America, was there's always a paranoid streak in this country from the get-go, you know, and I don't think that strand of thinking and feeling has ever really left, you know, going back and reading about American history, you know. So I don't think that paranoid streak. Hofstadter wrote a book.
Right, the paranoid style in American politics. He ran up.
Yeah, well, you know, in i.e. society, right? I don't think that has really ever left. I really don't. I think it's alive and well. I don't think it ever left. And, You know, I mean, what the founding fathers used to write in pseudonyms, right? They wrote in pseudonyms, and they were pretty tough on each other.
You know? Well, yeah, but the thing is, like, for instance, with, well, okay, where homosexuality is concerned, it's always been there. In fact, there are tantalizing tidbits, for instance, that suggest that the young Alexander Hamilton was bi, if not outright gay. And you know, other members of the revolutionary cadre. It's part of human nature throughout history. But where something and the common response to it was always to suppress it, you know, because of religion. On the other hand, where something like guns is concerned, it has not always been like it is now. There was a common understanding in this country that everybody walking around armed to the teeth was not a good idea, and it held for a good 100 years. And you know, even as far back as the origin days of the country, you know, you didn't go and walk into the ale house with your musket loaded and primed and the hammer back and the match or the cap or whatever ready to go. Because there was a common understanding that was a terrible idea. Among other things, because accidents happen.
Well, yeah, I don't know if you know, you can make limits to the amendments to the Bill of Rights. You can amend those. You know, they're not absolute.
Because they're amendments.
Right. So I mean, it's folly to say, well, this is the Constitution was absolute, right? It would be in its original form. You know, there'd be nothing changed from its original form. So that argument is just ignorant, you know? And it's unfortunate that we have people that have gone to really great universities, the best ones in this country, and play dumb and stupid, you know? That's what, you know, you'd expect people who are not allowed to have a higher education to be dumb. But when you hear educated people acting so juvenile...
Well, I mean, of course it can be changed. You know, we passed the 18th Amendment in introducing prohibition to the United States.
Yep. Yeah, that pastor, those pastors you played, it turned my stomach, to be honest with you. You know, the humanization of people, you know, and how they can, you know, hide behind, you know, saying that freedom of religion allows you to, like, hate like that. It's just too much for me, you know?
Well, but that, for me, the question is, and you know, I've put it forth before, the degree to which these religious monstrosities get a pass, and I don't mean just the ones who are out, you know, really kind of wackadoodle out there, as the Steven Andersons and what's his name, Kevin Swanson et al. But you know, the ones who are pillars of the community and stand up and speak in stentorian voices and adopt essentially the same policy. Okay, while Pope Frank has tried to strike a somewhat more conciliatory tone, the official policy of the Roman Catholic Church, which is, you know, as ecclesiastical and norm, you know, I guess normative as Christianity can offer, their policy is not much different. When the Roman Catholic Church offered a statement about Orlando, they only called the people who were shot and the people who were killed victims.
Yep.
Their gayness was erased, just like we were talking about last night.
Yeah. It's just sickening. I'm not going to keep you much longer, but I just had to tell you that, you know, these people get legitimate treatment. So for this freaking mainstream media we have, though, one last thing. I thought of this yesterday, if you don't mind, while you're here.
Oh, go ahead.
Mika Brzezinski, yesterday morning, you know, they played a clip of Elizabeth Warren going after Trump. And then she referred to them as insults. She goes, so before they played Elizabeth Warren's, riff on Trump, she goes, here are the insults of by Elizabeth Warren, you know? And so it just, I don't remember the last time a Republican went after a Democrat where somebody like Mika Brzezinski said, oh, Donald Trump's insults are about to begin on Hillary Clinton. You know?
Yeah.
It's just another example of how subliminal the mainstream media operates, you know? It's just disturbing. But there's so much to be disturbed about in our society these days. But it's been... things are more out in the open right now than I can remember in my life, but it's always been there, you know, on a certain level anyhow. So, it's unfortunate, but I guess we all have to try to make it better in our own way. You know, that's all we can do. And, I don't know what you think about that, but, so anyway, I don't want to keep you, but I guess it's disturbing and it's disgusting and appalling. And
the question that I cannot answer, Kevin, is how do we cleanse ourselves of this hate?
Well, what's that again?
How do we cleanse ourselves of this hatred? How do we make the Steven Andersons and the Kevin Swansons and all the homophobic priests and prelates and pontiffs and vicars and how do we make them stop it?
I have one idea that I think they get too much legitimate treatment, that they don't get enough scorn in society by the establishment types, give them too much respect. They get too much adoration for example, when bills come up and you know they're backed by these religious, like the American Family Association and all these types of groups, and they get to they lobby now and they get their, well, you know, that stuff has to be called out more into the public eye. People have to start to rail against that. People that are not of religious affiliation or preference have to start to organize against that. You know, say no. You know, we also have freedom against religion, and we don't. Want that written into the bill. We don't. Why should it be? Why should the Catholic hospitals get public funding or Medicaid or Medicare money if they're not going to carry out certain things that are allowed by the law? You know, why should they be exempt? You know, so things like that have to happen. You know, and these churches that hate have to be called. Put on hate group lists. You know, they can't be looked at as legitimate religious groups.
I think you're going in the same direction I am. ultimately, their ability to suck at the teat of the commons via their tax-free status has got to go.
Pretty much, yeah, because they're not operating in good faith anymore. They're operating now. I remember when John Paul came in as a pope, I saw the Catholic Church really get really political. I mean, maybe they always were, but I'm talking about my lifetime. I saw it really heat up when he came in and Ratzinger was with him. That's what I'm saying. You know, and of course the Falwell people and the Pat Nutty Robertson. You know, these people get too much legitimate treatment by the likes of MSNBC. You know, maybe it'd be better if Rachel Maddow didn't play these tapes of these people over and over again on the TV. You know, I don't know what that does except give them free TV time. You know, now I mean it's good to point it out, but there has to be more than just pointing it out. You know, I mean, yeah, you can point it out now to Doomsday, but that's all that's being done. It's not going to do anything. I don't think there's been enough organizing against these people. I think these people that you, especially the people you went over tonight, and I'm not saying this has nothing to do with you. When I say legitimizing, I'm not talking about you.
No, I understand.
You know, I want to make that clear. That's all. So, lest anybody thinks I'm inferring that. Okay, but I just think that these people need to be marginalized. You know, and that they have to be. You know, they have to be like that. Sandy Rios, to me, is well, didn't she recently tell people that the Trump people at the rallies should have had the gun, the M17, right, to blow away the people that were protesting, right? She thought the Trump people should have blew them away with guns. I mean,
yeah.
To me, a person like that, she should be investigated for that kind of thing. You know, these people, you know, when they make these statements, they can't. Sometimes, if they're gonna incite violence, you know, or make threats, you know, threats, they can't be getting away with it anymore. And that's up to the public to demand that these people start to play by all, you know, that they not get away with it anymore. And that's what has to be done. And I don't know what else. I mean, that's just my view on it. I mean, if sure, there might be better views than mine out there, but that's just, you know. So anyway, good show tonight, good show every night, and I'll let you go. And it was nice. Well, nice chatting with you.
Always a pleasure, Kevin.
Yeah, you know, you point out good things, you know, and you do it in a very, well, I think a lot of your show is comical. I love the introduction to your show, the cussing and discussing. That's a new one. But it's great, you know, it's very, very poignant, you know. So anyway, I hope you have a good night. I'm glad. I guess you weathered a storm. No storm last night?
No, there was a storm. It's just that we got through it without having our antiquated early 20th century technology coal-fired power grid knocked off.
I go to your Twitter every day to make sure you're having a show. So.
Well, I try to, unless I put something out there saying no show, you can always assume that there is a program.
Oh, no, I know, but I just go to your Twitter anyway every day just to, you know, and at night see when you put up the show.
Yeah, and thanks for reminding me. Yeah, for people, if there's ever a problem with Stitcher or TuneIn, the Podbean podcast goes up usually by about 11 o'clock every night Eastern time.
Yeah. No problem. I just wanted to tell you that. Anyway, always nice chatting with you.
Oh, it's a pleasure, Kevin. You have yourself a wonderful evening, and thanks for calling in.
Yeah, have a good day.
All right.
Good night.
Bye now. And from Kevin in Connecticut, we will run down to even warmer climes in Florida. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hey, Bob, you recognize the area code, huh?
I've memorized a few, yes.
Well, I appreciate that. You know, Bob, I'm only about a little over an hour from where the Pulse shooting took place, and I called the show last week. And I think, I can't speak for yourself, but we're both still talking about it. I think it bothers both of us. It should bother everybody, from a humanitarian standpoint. It bothers me a lot in so many different ways. You know, when I left off our conversation, my mind started to wander off in a different direction, but I wanted to share with yourself and the listeners, just to lend a little credibility back towards myself. When I saw the footage of some people that had their phones up that were filming from a distance, but what you weren't seeing anything on the film, but other than the background, you could see that they were filming from a 7-Eleven, which is apparently not real far from the club. And in that parking lot, you could hear the people holding their phones up, recording the sound of the shooting. You can hear them say, "Oh my God, they're killing them right now." When I first heard the story, so it's dramatic for all of us. It's equally dramatic for me. I'm a career soldier who gets done at the age of 30, in which people say in the Marine Corps after the age of 30 they're bureaucrats. You know, you better be a captain or an E-7 or E-8 by that age, because it's a super, super physical line of work. And I was a retread, so my days were numbered on my second go around, but I gave it my all. But what I wanted to share with yourself, Bob, is when I heard the staccato of the round of the fire, the repetitiveness of the shooting, I could immediately tell that it wasn't an automatic weapon, but it was a controlled shooting with the same rhythm. And what threw my mind off, where I was going with being a career soldier and a career construction person, and like many of us, I get up early. I get up like at 05, 06, and that particular morning, for whatever reason, I had slept until 7. So, like all of these breaking news stories, it seems like most of them are not catching me from a hypervigilant Marine's perspective off guard. Well, this one kind of caught me in the shorts because of its. I had to kind of shake my head for a second. Well, son of a bitch, that's a fucking club. I know exactly where it is. And I dropped a friend off there. I didn't know they had Latin nights. I do know there's a tremendous amount of Latin people, a huge Puerto Rican population. After the storm went through Miami, a lot of Puerto Ricans left Miami and relocated to Orlando. I did not know that until I started hanging around in Orlando a little bit when I had some time and money to myself. But getting back to the gunfire, I recognized that shooting, but I didn't recognize the noise. I recognized it was a gun, a rifle nature. That's no big revelation. But what I didn't know was it was a Sig Sauer. It was not an AR-15. And I've not heard a Sig Sauer rifle go off. I've heard maybe a Sig Sauer pistol, maybe not. On embassy duty, we had Uzi submachine guns, and of course you would know, but they're effing Israeli weapons. The Marines have squad automatic weapon fabriqué in Belgium, in Belgique, or however you pronounce that. So we have weapons, even in the American Marine Corps, that are not domestically produced. And so you do hear and see and take in different experiences. And it just kind of threw me, but just looking back in retrospect, just kind of combining the grogginess and then my G.I. Joe background, I was befuddled. I was like, holy shit, that's here. That's now. And having been a Marine and a policeman, what bothered me was I didn't know how to word this about myself, Bob, but I was thinking about it before I called the show an hour or two ago. I said, I'm going to try and explain it, Bob, if anybody could understand it, which many people could. You know, Bob definitely can. But that psychologically, for whatever reason, I became kind of a defensive person in life. I'm a big guy. I'm a strong guy. I'm an athletic guy. And I also, on my second tour of duty, I went right to Central America. And you always talk about Latin America. You talk about it in such depth that I learned from you, and even though I live there. So I never stop learning. So, but I think if the listeners knew my experience, how well they treated me there, not like royalty, but just so nicely. People always
like you, like a human being.
They were very civilized. The people that just were so glad to have a little stainless container of rice with a small beat up piece of the chicken in there, and they were always so happy, and a few people would carry machetes, and I'm like, shit, I was a kid that could have been a college athlete if it was more disciplined. I mean, I actually played basketball, Bob, for the University of Honduras. I was asked to come try out for a local adult baseball team. I did, and I made it, and I had a good arm, and they would have me pitch one inning and scared the hell out of everybody. and then they'd make me a catcher. But then, you know, and then when I was warming up the next pitcher, they'd have me throw down to second base and show people that the arm wasn't completely gone, because I could put the ball down there very accurately, very quickly. And, you know, like I said, I'm a big guy. And, but, you know, after the game, there was people, there were groups of us that we all went out and hung out together. I mean, it was my life. I didn't avoid the Marines I served with there at the American Embassy. Many of them, when I was off, they were working. So anytime I had my free time, I was dedicated to, self-educating, or to working out or playing literally, serious sports. And I played tennis with CIA agents. One guy I played with in Honduras had...
Do they cheat?
No, actually no. And I was going to make sure that they didn't. But no, matter of fact, Bob, most of the CIA people, the few that I knew that I came directly in contact with, were of a rather integrous nature. On one-on-one personality and on the tennis court. I never played golf with them. It's easier to cheat, I guess, in golf. But, you know... But I had no desire to, I wasn't a bad tennis player, so I wasn't going to let them win. I mean, I dove for shots. I was very aggressive. I was honest and actually a decent player as well. But these are college guys, and they played sports in college, some of them, and, you know, they're educated. So I was a blue collar kid. I was like, well, shit, most of the Marines I served with, even though they were embassy Marines, they didn't play tennis. Some of them did play sports, but most Marines, period, don't play tennis. Now, amongst the officer ranks, of course they do. And, of course, as an enlisted Marine, you ain't playing tennis with no officer. That's fraternization. You're lucky to even get in a conversation with one, which that's fine. I accepted that challenge. And another thing that I think a lot of civilians don't understand about the American Armed Forces is the Marine Corps has one officer per 100 enlisted men ratio, whereas the other branches, the Navy and the Army, have a 10 officer per 100. So they have a lot more, whatever you would call that, top-down or bureaucracy or whatever it's called. Now they may not broke down like that in a combat description in a field manual, but they have a lot more oversight. Whereas the Marines put a lot of pressure on the enlisted people, and they get their money's worth out of you, not just physically, but the they put a lot of pressure on you. And then when the Marines came out of the Korean War, which was a rescue mission when the U.S. Army, a lot of Puerto Rican Americans were serving as whites, were going on with their work, and a lot of blacks were in the Korean War, the Marines basically get involved. MacArthur knew who could do the rescue mission, and it happened to be the Marines. Basically, as the Marines came down out of the mountains, U.S. Army officers were standing there with Marine generals, the two groups, and the Army officers asked the Marine officers, why do your sergeants look like our captains? So literally is what the quote was. Now, Marines don't go around telling each other that. They don't say that. They don't say that to other soldiers. But when you learn that in retrospect, or if you learn that while you're in there, you realize if you exploit that, that makes you look unprofessional. But getting back to your observations. I was going to ask you, Bob, you remember Senator Allen for Virginia, correct?
George Makaka Allen, yes.
Right, whatever word, Hakuna Matata, but Makaka. So Allen, do you know what they found in his office, when they ran him out of it, literally what's hanging in there, right?
Noose, Confederate flag.
Yeah. He had a Confederate flag and a noose, an actual, I guess, a noose that meets the standards. Maybe already, just cut off short. I don't know. But, he's a Jewish American. So, and then you look at Mateen, he's an Arab American, or as Donald Trump
Afghan,
calls him,
Afghan
American, or he may be from
Brooklyn, actually he's yeah. He's a New Yorker American. He's from Queens.
He was born in the same hospital as Trump was, probably, right, Tom? Bob. So I mean, so what I'm saying is, I don't think I've ever told you, but when I was a union organizer here in Central Florida, I really got into my job, and one of the reasons I was selected to do the work is because of the language ability, and I loved it. I mean, we would write things in English and translate them by hand. I had Spanish partners, and of course we used the computers, and of course we were out in the field. I mean, I kind of lit a huge fire personally down here, and I got a lot of shit stirred up. And it was on the radio in Orlando, and it matriculated into various directions. But one of the groups, and of course you would be knowledgeable of them, were, remember the nuns that were killed under the Reagan administration.
Right.
Of course, you've got the School
and Bishop
of America.
And Bishop Romero.
And the, right, Archbishop Romero, shot by the same people that killed the nuns, where they were basically, not literally, but... they were all the murderers were trained at the school in Fort Benning.
And you know, to the extent that Romero was a proponent of liberation theology, it really didn't. I mean, they had to put on the show and everything, but it really didn't break the church up a whole lot, because the Roman Catholic Church at that time was decidedly anti-liberation theology, because, well, you know, that could get out of hand. And John Paul II was hardcore right wing, and you know that's kind of all forgotten, Mark, in the midst of his sanctification or whatever you call it. But he was, you know, he was halfway to a fascist.
Well, and you know, Archbishop Romero was probably halfway out the door, and he knew that when he made the stands that he made on that, and of course. Even though I had left literally Central America at that time, I had general knowledge of many things about Central America and many of the key players in the area, names and things. And so when all these things unfolded, to include, you know, Reagan with Iran-Contra and Oliver North, a lot of things kind of fell into place for me from an understanding standpoint. That Archbishop Romero, it's funny because the one of the largest Catholic churches in Los Angeles. They said, well, Jesus, it's so bad. Let's start actually feeding people out of our soup kitchen instead of, like, the way I interpret any type of religion in my own life's experience and looking at life, period, is, and I say it to people. I mean, I say, you know, you seem to talk about religion, you talk at religion, but you don't do anything about it. I said, fucking Fidel Castro was a Catholic, and he took the values that he was taught and did something with them instead of you people just fucking looking at people and taking cash from the poor. I said, he's taking what he learned, the values of fairness, and trying to execute something to help his folks. He wasn't marching people around with some, you know, communist manifestos. And you didn't even have the courage to defend your own country, and you want a college dropout like myself, who happened to be a damn good Marine, to go back there and free your country. I get in these discussions in person or on Facebook or wherever the case may be. So these are based, a lot of my interpretations have come through a combination, just like anybody else's, from foundations of actual life experiences and self-taught things and interpretations of things. So I have much respect for Fidel Castro. I would love to meet him before he dies, but I know that's not going to be a reality for me. I would love to shake his hand and tell him how brave that I know that he is and how much he loves his people. But, you know, and so when you say this, Jesus, and they find out you're a Marine, well, automatically, you know, people are going to hang a label on you. I really don't give a shit, because I respect courage if it's based. I respect courage, period. But it has to be based in positive things. But I wanted to just say that when I worked as a union organizer, Bob, there in Orlando, that I got the chance to work with some nuns that were put in a situation where they were helping people that were coming out of the muck farms, which the muck farms were being closed down and apartment buildings were coming up right where they're at. So the Mexican immigrants there and Central Americans rolled right over into construction. So we thought, well, let's find some allies And we work with these nuns, and these were some high-speed people. And one of the people who you could actually know, I don't remember the gentleman's name right now. If I did, I don't know that I'd say it over the air. But one of the guys that they work with, a man, talk about a squared away looking dude, and talk about the composure of a professional soldier but not being one, was a bodyguard for none other than the Mexican-American organizer from California that was murdered. So, any case, just touching base with what Kevin said, I understand what he's saying. He never used the word fairness doctrine, and I agree with having to get the word out about pushing back. But if we put it all on Rachel Maddow's shoulders, which I'm not saying that's what Kevin is saying, but something to that effect, if we put it on just a few people's shoulders to communicate these things, those people are already going to be relieved of duty. They're already targeted anyway. So we ask people. So we are being shut down and replaced. And so I would throw out Senator Allen. I would throw out Mateen, the shooter. I would throw out Zimmerman, who is a mixed up a person himself. And I would throw out a lot of the evangelical Mexicans that I saw that were being organized by the evangelical churches there in Orlando. They didn't even respect their own heritage anymore. They were expunged of their history.
Well, many people don't know, Mark, that the evangelicals have made tremendous inroads in both Central and South America, and Mexico as well, because Mexico is technically North America. That is not a good thing.
I agree.
Because it's these prosperity gospel types. Because while maybe a few pesos is all you've got, if you get a whole bunch of people's few pesos, you can start pricing Gulfstream jets, okay?
Halfway.
There are tremendous inroads being made, and it's in its own way terrifying. Now, I wanted to mention something to you because I wasn't sure if you'd seen it, since you do have some experience in that area, and you know the club, you know where it is, you've seen it, you've been there, you've dropped people off there. And of course there's really no way to judge the credibility of this claim, but according to the Associated Press, a man was interviewed on Univision today under the pseudonym Miguel. And he said that he had met Omar Mateen on the app called Grindr. It's a gay dating app. And he said he had about 15 liaisons with him at a no-till motel, and that they were kind of friends with benefits. And those 15 to 20 hookups were over the course of a couple of months. But what's particularly interesting out of this, especially in light of the fact that the right wing, the Jesus freaks and whatever, continue, and Wayne LaPierre, like we had last night, continue to blather on and on about, we're on the verge of collapse from ISIS attacking us. According to this guy, Miguel, what happened at Pulse was a revenge killing. Almost half of the people killed at Pulse were Puerto Rican Latinos. And according to Miguel, Mateen was infuriated because he had been rejected by some Puerto Rican gay men and had also had at least one encounter with a Puerto Rican gay man who turned out to be HIV positive. So, this becomes both more and less complex at the same time. And I think it bears out my theory that as he knew the end was coming, he hollered Aloha Snack Bar, or I'm with Hezbollah and ISIS, or whatever, things that made absolutely no sense whatsoever, because otherwise he knew his daddy was going to find out that his homicidal little boy was gay.
Well, you know, Bob,
and here's, you know, here's the sad part, that in his death and after all of this massacre, after all of this mayhem, the fact that his son was gay would have been a greater shame to daddy than the fact that his son murdered 49 people and maimed 53 more.
Well, I mean, if you looked at the news, and some of it, I don't even want to hear what some people are saying. It was just so overwhelming. And I was like, I would see him, and I may not have the sound on. I might have been on the internet. I'm like, that son of a bitch looks like a kook. And in fact, he said what you are saying right now immediately afterwards, and he has said it subsequently. What we're expressing. I was gonna. You made a comment last week, and it immediately made sense to me, and I thought it was hilarious because Southern Air Transport airplanes were easily available to see if you drove by the right corner of the airport in Miami from the very day that I got there. And I said, well, shit, those look like the planes I used to see. Well, that's right, when I was in Central America. But and then lo and behold, there were people that I knew that I didn't know that would be coming and going. And I was like, well, and then a comment was made on your show that, you know, half of the people in Florida could be involved with the intelligence agency. And you go downtown Miami, and it's been there 30 or 40 years. Mellon Bank.
Going all the way, you know, going out all the way back to pre-Kennedy. Florida was a staging ground for Central American dirty tricks by the CIA.
Certainly. I've actually been like many people, but I've actually been in that Orange Bowl where John F. Kennedy, you know, spoke to the 1506 Brigade or whatever it was, and it was just something else. I thought that I'm not asking you to agree with me, but just throwing that out. You know, it kind of hit me after all of my life experiences, after literally having served in Central and South America for practically 4 years and playing tennis with people and reading and learning, that the evangelical churches that I witnessed in Orlando, there's some connection between them and the CIA and financial and the evangelical.
Oh, I wouldn't doubt that for a damn minute, Mark.
Right, Pat Robertson, he's been a Bush family.
I mean, remember the origins of Billy Graham are as an enforcer for capitalism, a spiritual enforcer for capitalism. Billy Graham got his start because a lot of money got behind him to preach against the rising tide of a more socialist, and I would argue, more authentic gospel.
Right. A real gospel. Yeah. A helpful gospel. Right.
Well, you know, a gospel that says, if you've done it unto the least of these, my brothers, you've done it also unto me. That ain't capitalism.
Then you read Kevin Phillips, who, when I saw him after reading his book, after I'd read the other book about the Bush family, the American Dynasty, I watch him on C-SPAN. And Kevin Phillips, who's over 80 at the time, turns to the TV and says, the Bush family scares me. And I helped get Richard Nixon elected in the South, which was...
He invented the Southern strategy.
Exactly. That's Billy Graham is the Southern strategy. John F. Kennedy's assassination is a part of that at the beginning of all this.
Well, one of the first denominations that they co-opted was the Southern Baptist Church, because the Southern Baptist Church had a history of racist behavior. The Southern Baptist Church became the Southern Baptist Church in issues relating to race. And so they were ripe for the picking. Jerry Falwell was a member of the Southern Baptist Church. So it was, well, you know, easy.
It's like if you read Diane McWhorter's book about Carry Me Home, about how the steel industry was prevented from organizing primarily in the South, but primarily in Alabama, who the Concerned Citizens Coalition was, who their tie-ins were, the Klan, and the Southern Baptists were also mentioned in that book. They all were running hand in hand, and what we still have in these red states are the legacy, the modern John Wayne Rambo version of kookiness. I mean, with no actual reality that they think you should carry machine guns in the nightclubs now.
Well, I mean, look, the Orlando, as mentioned previously, the Orlando massacre happened even as the Southern Baptist Convention's so-called messengers were sitting down in convention assembled, and the first thing they did was pass a resolution calling the victims of Orlando image bearers of God, but once again erasing their gayness. And then they followed that up with resolution number 3, which was all about going potty.
Right, right. Because that's where it all starts.
Mark, these people are freaks. I mean, the for-profit media can dance around them, but I won't. I mean, they're freaks. They're goons. They're thugs.
They scare me.
They're theocratic zealots.
They are the arm of the party that just hasn't taken action yet. And when you mentioned at the beginning of the show, if they get their way, it would make the mullahs of Iran blush, and I agree. You can just feel it, especially I think living south of the Mason-Dixon. But it's already underway, and it's got a lot of things in place, and it is scary. If we don't recognize that. But like Kevin said, where is this discussed? We can't create a group to repel this. It just has to be repelled as it comes. It's just like what people have to do, just like the protests in Iran where the beautiful girl was shot standing with her friends that were all doctors in the head, and they were protesting pro-Western values, shot by the mullah's security, the remnants of Savak, but the theocratic Savak in fucking Iran. It's really we are no different here in the United States. If anything, we are on the brink of something possibly worse, and throwing people off of buildings because of who they want to hang out with. There are many people. I can't even read shit, Bob, on Facebook. I can't even go there. And when people take photographs of people's comments from some of the right wing sites, I can't even look at them. I can't even hardly glance at him. It's too much for me, man. It's so sickening. I'm like, I served my country in my mind to protect all of this. And I didn't ever really know that this extremist was there. And when I was a little kid, Bob, we'd go by the Caterpillar plant in my hometown in Springfield, a huge fucking plant. It'd take 4 streetlights to get down to the corner to make the left, to get to the left, the other side of the end of the plant, to get to the plant that we were heading to go to work at. And there was the church along the way there. And almost any time I'd go to work with my dad, no matter what age I was, he would look over at that church. And my dad never said shit about anybody. He never put anybody, he never used the N-word. He never said anything about people that were gay or artistic. And what was the piano player? It was very flamboyant.
Liberace.
Yeah, my dad never... You know, Liberace was on TV all the time. My dad was some bitch is talented or something, you know, but he never, I was lucky. I didn't have a dad that said a bad thing. But when we go by that church, he'd look over and then look straight ahead and go, huh. And then finally, I mustered up the courage over time. And I said, what is it, Dad? And he goes, those are a bunch of phonies. I said, oh okay. And then I wouldn't say nothing. I was like, what is he talking about? What is he talking about? And really, in retrospect, what my dad was telling me in the 60s is what it is and always has been today, is the hypocrisy. My father also would do the similar comment on the other side of the lake. We're talking about a 10-mile trek to get to the plant, which is nothing for a lot of big city folks, but where I grew up, that was a ways. And so you get to the other side of the plant, and we'd get off work, and we'd go to the back side of the lake, and there was an American Legion thing there. And he would look at that once in a while, and he'd go, huh, like that. And so finally, again, I mustered up the courage. I said, Dad, what is it? And he goes, those are a bunch of phonies. And that's all he'd say. He wouldn't go on and on about it. But
sounds like you had a good dad.
I did have a good dad, Bob. My dad, and actually my dad scouted, I didn't even know it till a couple years ago, Bob. My first living as a little kid at 2 and 3 years old was in government housing. I never knew that. It didn't matter. I mean, it still doesn't matter, but I didn't know that because we eventually got on our feet, but it was with the government's help. My dad had a government job. And so I defend, even though I'm a part of organized labor, which is very aggressive, I defend public service unions. I don't give a shit. They're just...
Well, you know what? We would be a lot better off if they were a lot more like you and the other organized labor members of the Horn Family Community Congregation. For instance, the AFL-CIO and the United Mine Workers of America here in West Virginia have gone completely off the rails. They're out there running around endorsing incumbent Republican House members. I kid you not.
In West Virginia, right, Bob?
Yeah.
Well, they want to bring that coal back, baby. We've lost all these jobs.
In the gubernatorial election, we had a candidate running for governor named Jeff Kessler, who every time labor needed a friend, sometimes he was standing out there all by himself. And labor was damn glad to have him. But when he ran for governor, they ran over and backed a goddamn billionaire named Jim Justice, the biggest empty suit to come down the pike in this state since Joe Manchin put on long pants.
Labor backed this dude over Kessler?
Oh, hell yes. I mean, at this point in time, and the thing is, these are the same leaders who said when we got our teabagger legislature in, well, you know, we can work with them. I mean, you know, did anybody bring the kazoo? Could we get the pitch pipe out? Let's sing Kumbaya. And proceeded to get their asses handed to them. And yet the same people who advised the strategies that got their asses handed to them are still in power. Because they keep saying, well, you know, we can work with them. And the reason I thought about this is something that you just said along the lines of, you know, you'll advocate for public employees unions. Well, the other thing you advocate for is a living wage. And I know you believe in an increase in the minimum wage. You oppose nefarious shit like cutting food stamps. Well, you know what? The leadership of labor in West Virginia has gone completely igum-foo. You know, I got mine, you. And they don't give a goddamn what happens to the poor. They don't give a goddamn about the minimum wage. They don't nothing except. I mean, and I understand caring about the issues that are most important to you, but they care about them to the exclusion of other things. So while they sat there singing Kumbaya, the teabagger legislature got rid of prevailing wage on a state level and and introduced us to the glories of right to work.
That's right. That's approved in West Virginia, right, Bob?
Oh, it's the law of the state, yeah. And if the teabaggers don't get thrown out in November, we're done.
You know, the behavior you're describing, with it's really a small group of people in leadership that are, you know, it's not unlike the Bernie Sanders versus Hillary struggle. It's you know, these are people that are locked in. They have their jobs, literally their own job, and a few other people helping them that have their own job, against people that think that we're in place to help everybody. And so, therefore, what you're describing does take place in all unions. Some of them are more squared away and fair about it than others. And of course, being a legitimate union member, I'm not supposed to discuss specifics, and I know that's not what you're eliciting about what I'm involved with, but there are some major, major things at play with the people that I'm associated with, which are huge. And they incorporate the last administration, and they go on to the current direction we're headed. So, it's not professional for me to discuss that publicly. So therefore I won't, but I can make analogies, with exactly what you're talking about with, what you see right there. And the sad thing is, and I do this on all of my jobs, whenever I get anywhere, I can't just be an arbitrary agitator, but there are many people, I will say this, many people in labor have no fucking clue to begin with. They don't know right to work, from prevailing wage to Davis Bacon. They don't know minimum wage is something that shores us up. They don't know. So, you know, so when I hear some bullshit,
not only do they not know, Mark, they don't know they don't know. And that's what makes them dangerous.
That's another thing my old man used to say. He'd say, Mark, some people just don't know. They just don't know. He would say they don't know any better. And it's basically the same thing. They just don't know which they don't know. And so I have to be diplomatic, because unbeknownst to people that could be listening to this conversation right now, whether you're an organized labor in construction or not, you have to perform on the job. Or as we used to say, your ass will be run off by the first break. You won't even make it to fucking lunch, buddy. You'll be lucky to make it to the 9 o'clock break, is what we say to each other to keep pressure on ourselves and reality, or I'll throw you off this motherfucking roof. How about that? You think this is a fucking joke? I got babies to feed, man. Give me that motherfucking saw. You know, and it's a rough world up there, bro. And, so, you know, I'm a real, you know, I live by reality. So, but I let people know, different things that they're associated with, and how they cannot know important things like prevailing wage or whatever. So, you know, I lost my train of thought because of a vehicle just started right next to me. I guess I'm easily thrown off, but I'm still working.
Well, let me shift gears on you a minute, Mark, and just ask you a quick question. Based upon your history, based upon your experience, you know, you talked about the Belgian-made firearms with which you were equipped. You talked about Uzis. From where you stand, Mark, as someone who has used these things as a function of your professional military life under oath and under the colors, is there any compelling argument for civilians owning these damned things?
I don't see it, Bob. No, I don't see it personally. I don't see it. I also, to answer your question, because it's happened every time we've had a shooting, I'll get on Facebook pages where people know about my background. I'll literally put photographs of certificates of completion of training that are not from Phoenix, online academy from the Phoenix, these are real courses. These are real commendations. I'll put things on there, and then people will make comments like stolen valor, because I don't use the language that they think that they should be hearing. And so suddenly your integrity's in question. But, you know, so, one of the things I say to people is, if you had carried these weapons for a living, you'd just be tired of carrying the motherfuckers. The shit is fucking heavy. Bullets are heavy. The gun is heavy when it's loaded. You're carrying ammunition on your waist and on your chest with your other gear, with water. And you're looking to see if you have to grab somebody else's gear to help them along. Because if we don't all get to where we're going, we ain't worth a motherfucker. So that's the mentality of a Marine. And so you do this job for a living, and they say, hey, Mark, you can make the same amount of money that you make in busting your fucking ass, but you ain't got to bust your ass no more. Would you consider that? And idealistically, there were times when I would say no. But as we go through life, when the body starts saying, theory versus reality, at some point you come to a conclusion either from hurting people you shouldn't have hurt, hurting people you should have hurt, but it's now bothering you, or just fucking sheer fatigue. You don't want to carry these heavy objects. And one thing I learned at being a cadet at a police academy, which lasted 6 months, where they taught constitutional law to cardiopulmonary resuscitation to every fucking thing that was necessary, like reality training, street training, combat training, all kinds of shit that they did at the police academy that I attended, which is a state-credited and a nationally recognized academy. One of the first things they teach you when it comes to weapons is that you can never outdraw somebody that has their weapon drawn on you.
You can't get the drop on somebody who's got the drop on you, right?
The fact, I don't give a shit. That's like saying I'm standing on the pitcher's mound and I've already got my foot up in the air and I'm coming at you, and you as a catcher, you can throw the ball back at me and before I can get it to you. I mean, it just doesn't make sense mathematically. It's not. And actually, Bob, I'm not bragging, but I fired distinguished fucking experts. That a 300 is a perfect score. I shot a 298.6, and they couldn't find one of my bullets. And an instructor said that, well, you may have had two go through one. So it could have been a 299.5 or some bullshit. But they gave me a little bit of credit. And then and above that is a blue max. I shot a white max or some shit. And below that is expert. But this wasn't just standing and breathing and taking your time and lining up sight. This started at the 7-yard line with combat shooting out of a clamshell holster with Pockmeyer rubberized grips, and you had to get so many rounds off, fire, reload with the speed loader, which was on your hip, get off the next set of rounds, drop back to the 15-yard line, drop down behind a barrel, fire right-handed, left-handed, drop back to the next line. And so this was a combat authenticated course for law enforcement. And I shot really well on it because I fucking was trained really well as a fucking...
Right, and none of that, in most instances, probably the majority of instances, none of that obtains in regard to some goober who walks in and buys an AR-15 or an MCX or whatever in 8 minutes' time in a gun store in Florida with a Washington State driver's license.
Who had the Washington license, him?
No. That was an experiment that was done last week.
Yeah.
I mean, but it took 37 minutes because there were so many people buying those guns right now.
Well, certainly, and I was familiar with that. And now, what you're describing there, and what one of the other things I would say, and it's repulsive for me to say it, but what my team did, I took a sense of organization, self-discipline, and prior skills. And he had help from that wife, was helpful. She helped do reconnaissance mission. And one of the things they just said on the news yesterday that I heard for the first time is there was an argument as he's leaving the house to go there at midnight. Now St. Lucie to Orlando is about a 2.5-hour drive, maybe 3 hours. And he leaves with a duffel bag full of weapons, of which I don't know what all is in there, ammunition, of course, too. And they're fighting as he leaves. So she knew. She knew when he left the house that there was intent there. And she had helped do recon. And then someone says to me on Facebook today, and I know we're starting to get that in these conversations that we have over your show, but people get upset about something on fucking Facebook, and people are like, who gives a shit? The point is, people are saying, well, I don't know about her. I'm like, or him. Even going to the club, yeah, he may have been miffed about the relationship with his Puerto Rican lover, which may or may not be true, which it very well could be. But he didn't go in at midnight with his NYPD shirt on to see that boyfriend. He went in there to do a final recon. And that shooting that they show on CNN, which we could get right now on YouTube, that shooting with the repetitive firing is a trained shooter, and it's literally what I said at 7.
Well, yeah, I mean, he was working private security for an outfit that had a Department of Homeland Security contract.
Right. So, you know, and this guy, and I'll throw another observation. I don't think I said this last week on the show. You know, no huge revelation, but it's symptomatic of what they're discussing literally tonight on the floor of the Congress is he bought that weapon, the MCX, and within a week he was using that motherfucker. So he thought in his mind that after my interviews with the FBI, I'm already going to red flag myself. So he knew with time he was going to be under the gun, so to speak, I believe. And so therefore the mission, so he'd been training with another gun. I'd like to know where he'd been shooting an equivalent weapon, which could have been with GS4, whatever the name of that stupid-ass company is, a privatized company that Bush wanted people to make $7 an hour for them to do the Homeland Security at the stupid.
Well, that or, you know, God, how many public gun ranges or gun clubs are there around Port St. Lucie?
Oh, well, you can just drive down US 1 and see quite a few, and I'm sure there's more there than I realize. I don't personally, I mean, I know the area and have worked in the area, you know, and that's not what Bob.
So just to sort of circle us back for a minute, Mark. You have, if I understand you correctly, you have no sympathy for that dude that wrote the essay, I guess, last week or whatever, saying that he had an AR-15 because the AR-15 is the ultimate Lego set for grown-ups, and he wanted a gun that he could shoot varmints or 500-pound feral hogs with and defend his home with, yada, yada, yada.
I don't know that I caught that one. I thought you were getting ready to talk about the uniformed Secret Service agent with his devastating fake political book. But no, I hadn't heard about this essay, and I don't know that had I seen it, I would have wanted to look too much at it, especially if there's a picture of somebody's face associated with it. Just looks stupid. But just describing what you're talking about there. If you use a fucking rifle in a house, that bullet's going to, as you got a burglar in your house and you're going to use an AR-15 or an M16 and you shoot, you can actually hit the burglar, kill the burglar. The round's going to continue to go
through the burglar, through the wall, and wipe out precious pumpkin in her crib.
Right. So it's a good house clearing weapon if you have.
If you don't care about anybody in the house.
Well, exactly. And physically, Bob, it has that collapsible stock, which allows you to, whenever you go physically around a corner, you draw the weapon in to make it shorter because you want your face to be looking right at the fucking end of the barrel, what's right above it. And when you drop back around the corner, even the position of your feet makes a difference between where you get shot at. Because if you have the wrong foot, if you look around a corner with a loaded pistol or a rifle, and you happen to get shot right then, when your body goes down, you're going to fall out in what's called the cone of fire or the line of fire. If you have the correct foot and the up against the corner of the building as you look around it and you get shot, it will knock you back out of the line of fire, and the guy that just shot you won't know what happened to you. He doesn't know if he fucking left to come circling back around him for all he knows. So unless he's got a set of balls and comes charging at you. So, you know, everything makes sense, and people say, well, you know, and it's not their fault, but civilians don't understand. There was a cop there at the front of the front of the fucking building who dropped back probably to make sure the club doors were getting secure. I don't fucking know. And he hears some shooting and comes charging up there. And I just read today for the first time, and it's been out there probably, but he gets on his radio, calls for some type of backup. Now, off-duty cops, having been a fucking off-duty cop and an on-duty cop, you have an off-duty channel, and you can go to an on-duty channel, which will represent the geography, the jurisdiction that you're in. So 3 would be for 30 sector, 2 would be for 20 sector, 1 would be for 10 sector. So if you're working in 30 sector, you go from your off-duty channel, which might be 5, you jump over to 3 and say, I got a 315, I got an officer down, I got an emergency, whatever your code is for that. So who shows up is a fucking sergeant, a lieutenant, and I think a regular cop, and I think the 4 of them, I presume all 4 of them go charging back into the club and confront this motherfucker, and he drops back deeper into the club, but he outfires them. So the good guy with the gun thing that what you and I would both laugh at should be laughed at, because I don't give a shit. If you got pistols and a dude's got a rifle, he's going to pin you down, and he's got plenty of ammo. And then what people say, oh, well, he had a vest, and he talked about a vest and a bomb. Well, you know, there's a part of me that I'm still so worked up about it after having been G.I. fucking Jane, willing to die for people that I'd never fucking meet, that I would have charged that motherfucking building at this age thinking somebody's got a fucking bomb on them? Fuck my motherfucking nuts. I ain't scared of your fucking bomb, you fucking weirdo. I'm coming in to get you. I'm killing you, motherfucker. And if that bomb goes off, you're history too, bitch. So I got those set of nuts on me. I don't talk this way.
Well, it's from what we know, you know, there was fire. There was return fire, and somewhere along the way, I mean, there was a display of significant courage.
Yes, there was, and actually
because Mateen had the advantage. He knew where he was.
And he had this weapon, Bob, whether it's the AR-15. A lot of this shit came out after my time. I'm honest enough to admit that. You know, you could be any age and be proficient with a weapon, but they did have collapsible shoulder stocks when I was in the Marine Corps. But that weapon was probably drawn up as he comes to the club from a revealment standpoint, hiding it. And that's how he gets through the door. And yes, the first shootout is with an off-duty uniform City of Orlando cop. He calls for help. They show up within just a couple minutes. I don't know. It's like 3 or 4 or 5 minutes. They're there. And because that part of Orlando, Scott, it's right on the edge of the highway. There's a lot of cops just out on patrol. The fucking jail's not too far from there. Florida's like the DMZ anyway. There's just got a shitload of cops.
In any case, you said it. I did not. Yeah.
Well, you know, having working all over the country still to this day, the minute you get out of Florida, you know, especially out of North Florida, you're like, you don't even see any fucking cops. Of course, Georgia, you still do. But once you, you know, you don't see them after a certain point in the United States. But, you know, so, but you get in this, those two sets of cops in their just their regular uniforms, whether they have a vest. And see, another thing is the rifle round will go through a vest that a police officer wears, most likely, even the some of the most expensive ones. Now, something that the super high end ones that are, you know, $6,000 to $8,000, or like what my team wanted to get, there are some that are available, and it alerted them. He wasn't too sharp about that. He could have gotten that type of vest through subtle means or through the internet a year in advance. So there was some emotionality in this murder case. I mean, he wasn't as pragmatic as he could have been. And thank goodness. But I wonder how many lives that the first cops interrupted from being killed, and the second. And I congratulate them. I mean, you said it yourself just now that they had a lot of courage. I'm not saying the SWAT team didn't do a good job, but you know, it's like I'm wondering today. It kind of hit me. Their current chief of police for City of Orlando, not Orange County. Not the black sheriff, but the white chief of police for City of Orlando. He's former SWAT, and I'm wondering if he wasn't one of the people or the bottom line to kind of give the nod when to go or not to go. I don't know, or how much he was involved with the.
Yeah, you'd have to know you'd have to know their rules of engagement in order to answer a question like that.
Well, he does, and he did know them. But where Mark's going, Bob, on my observation is, was there trepidation with the three-hour delay, because he did have SWAT background, and he enunciated it a couple times. In my mind, when I heard it, the language made sense. The timing did not. What he said was it went from, you know, a killing situation to a hostage. And, in fact, it kind of does. But it's also a hostage situation during the killing, if you want to be technical about it, because there are some people that are not allowed to escape, even though there's no demands being made. That's technically... a hostage is being held against your will, but you know, the point is, and I'm wondering, his training or his sympathy for SWAT team people, he kept them from arbitrarily getting killed. Now, I thought, as a solution between all of these extremes, in my mind, after having been G.I. Joe again, is what I'd like to see is what we do have in the Marine Corps. You have a 13-man squad, and a platoon may have four squads in it. And every squad has a squad leader, but every squad has three fire teams, and every fire team has a fire team leader. So what I'd like to have seen is once, and I know when you call SWAT, they're not out, all out on the road Sunday night. They've got to come from home with their pagers. They got to get their shit on. A lot of them do carry their weapons in their vehicle as well as they should and their safety gear. But some of them may have had to grab some shit. I don't know. But let's say, well, let's give them the benefit of a doubt of a fucking hour to get there. So they're there because there's not going to be a lot of traffic on a Sunday night. I'm going to conservatively give them an hour or maybe an hour and 15 minutes. But the point is they could have gotten a smaller group of SWAT people together than a whole team, which I don't know what the size of their teams are, and charge this motherfucker. They've got those bulletproof shields. They could have acted quicker in my mind. I don't give a fuck about your bomb comments. Your language doesn't concern me. My job is to save the public. And if you don't have that kind of courage and dedication to being a public servant, don't put the fucking uniform on. Go sell insurance because that's what you need to be doing. And definitely don't be on the fucking SWAT team. Now, I know SWAT team members, and there's been a member, by the way, come out on some social media site complaining about something. I have not had time to hear the story and how legitimate. I'm sure it has to have some credibility to it. But so there may be some malfunction amongst the ranks there. I don't know. But the point is, it just seemed they could have operated on a smaller scale with an equal lethality, and they could have confused the fucker by detonating in one spot and detonating in another and charging in another spot or charging where they detonated, whatever the case may be. And you can't have crossfire. I mean, there's a lot of things that go into that. I understand that. But it doesn't take much time to figure things out in a square fucking building, one-story building. You can do it. It takes courage and leadership and balls and calmness. So I'm upset because I feel a vulnerability for the poor Latinos that come to this country, many of them still fresh from Puerto Rico to the United States, many of them believing in us, many of them having family members that are totally, truly dedicated to the country, proud to be Puerto Rican. I don't give a damn if they're Puerto Rican or not, but they're vulnerable amongst Americans. I'm jaded. I've been jaded for a long time. I'm rough. I'm rougher than I even sound on this radio, this telephone call. That's because I've lived in this country. I've seen things, and I've participated in a few things. So things do surprise me, but I feel sorry that I wasn't able to protect them. I feel bad about that. And it's not my fault, but I do.
Yeah?
Yeah. I'm so sorry for it.
That's okay, Mark. That's okay.
They didn't deserve that, and I wish I could have helped them. I really would. They're such loving people. Not because they were gay. A lot of those people weren't even gay. You know? It was Latin night. Who gives a shit if somebody's fucking gay? These are the most vulnerable people amongst the society are the immigrants that believe in the country. And they're like children, but they're adults, and we owed them that. And something's not right about the situation, and I'm not out to badmouth the people that wear the uniform.
I mean, you've got the experience, and there is something difficult to articulate that is troubling you. I understand that, Mark. And I really appreciate the knowledge and the expertise that you've brought to the conversation this evening. I always enjoy our phone calls, without a doubt, my friend.
Yeah. All right, Bob. Well, I appreciate the question, and I appreciate your sincerity. And I can't even talk to my own wife about it, Chris. You know, she didn't relate to me when I did the job in uniform. She said, well, what did you expect? You know, I saw a lot of shit in the short time I was in Miami. And, but I served to help the innocent amongst us. And I think all public servants, no matter what you do, that's what you are doing, whether you're a nurse or a doctor or a teacher or a radio show host that has a heart and a mind that helps us all. I think any of the listeners that appreciated it.
Take care, my friend. Take care, Mark. Be well.
Yeah.
Later now. Calling from Florida. That's our buddy Mark. And so I didn't know I didn't know the issues. I didn't know there were issues regarding response times. And I would have been ill-prepared and ill-suited to even talk about them. But once again, what happens here is that people bring their own expertise to bear, no matter how difficult it may sometimes be. And I, like you, I'm sure, thank Mark for his sharing. I suppose, I mean, you know, it's prayer meeting Wednesday, and we got more prayer meeting Wednesday stuff. But at the same time, you know, there was a sit-in today in the House of Representatives. Tired of the inaction over the self-built, self-inflicted abattoir that our country has become. Some members of the House of Representatives, supported by some members of the United States Senate, including Bernie Sanders, launched a sit-in in the well of the House of Representatives. They were led by a man who knows a little bit about sit-ins. John Lewis. And I appreciate the sentiment. I don't know if one would even begin to try to compare or create a continuum of courage, but John Lewis's life has been a life of courage. I know he pissed off a lot of Bernie's supporters with some of his remarks earlier in the campaign regarding his support for Hillary Clinton. But this wasn't, you know, this wasn't a campaign stunt. This was an act of conscience. You know how you know it was an act of conscience? Because of the way that the shitbird Republicans behaved. Calling it a publicity stunt. Justin Amash, who he's from Michigan, I think. Justin Amash, who was sort of a progressive hero some time back for some maneuvering he did, said of the sit-in, "Democrats are staging a sit-in on the House floor. They refuse to leave until our Constitution replaces due process with secret lists." Well, no, you merciless bastard, you. They're refusing to leave the floor until we do something about mopping up all the goddamn blood that the Republican Party and their owners in the National Rifle Association insist on dumping all over this country until we all look like the final scene from Carrie. Meanwhile, Carol Baker tells me that MSNBC is going wall-to-wall coverage of a Trump rant while ignoring the sit-in. Journalism, Carol says, and I agree with her, is dead. one of the members of the House that for whom I have a great deal of respect, Representative John Yarmuth of Kentucky, is participating. He has a well sorted out moral conscience, because he's the one who will in January in the new Congress reintroduce the AIC Act. It's the right thing to do, but it's also sadly an act of desperation. Because the largest, most powerful, most well-funded terrorist organization on earth, the National Rifle Association, is trying to see to it that more 24-year-old men don't become 25-year-old men. That more children don't live to be teenagers. And, of course, the Republicans and some Democrats will gladly reach their slimy little mitts out to receive the payday for their behavior from the NRA. So while I admire the sentiment, and I admire the determination, and yes, even to a certain extent, there's some courage involved, I remain skeptical of this country's ability to do anything about our abattoir until such time as we do something about the organizations and individuals who create and maintain it. Because what we're looking at is a legal system in a state of complete collapse. So that's where we find ourselves this evening. Tomorrow, of course, Thorn in the Side Thursday. Come on, Bob. Thorn in the Side Thursday. And unless things change, Thorn in the Side Thursday will feature a $409 fundraising goal. And back into the hole we go. Thank you very kindly to Brother Deacon Asa and A. Nani Moose for taking care of the remainder of Matt and San Francisco's challenge. Thank you. Have a good night, everybody. Thanks to our all-volunteer staff. Thanks to Coal River Mountain Watch. And always, 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 Gina, it's all for you. Good night, y'all.